like to talk to you about today. Obviously, the National September 11th Memorial Museum in New York, and the presentation today is regarding the technical design of how we design the audiovisual delivery systems and the presentation systems that are in all the exhibitions. So this is not about the content, this is about the technical design of how we actually constructed the systems in there, in the museum. Someone said, and it's hard to know if this is absolutely correct, but there's probably some truth to it, that September 11th, from a media standpoint, was the most covered event in history. So we had an enormous amount of media to edit, to select, to review for the presentations. In the exhibition, there are over 140 programs running simultaneously through the exhibition. So there is an enormous amount of media in the exhibition and available throughout the facility. The presentation I'm going to make today has three parts. First, I'll tell you a little about the museum itself. Then I'll talk a little about the technical design. And then in the end, I have some photographs to show you of the exhibition space. Our role was the design of all the media in the exhibition itself. The project was so large, it was broken into smaller teams. So our role was all of the exhibition, which was a huge space, but that was just our part of it. Just to tell you a little about the geography, if you travel to New York and you have the opportunity to come to the museum, if you are in Lower Manhattan, where the museum is, there is a lot to do. I would suggest that you allow the day. The museum itself, which I'll describe the exhibition in a moment, takes several hours to go through, but you are at this point within walking distance of being able to go to the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island, the New York Stock Exchange, the Museum of Jewish Heritage, and the Smithsonian, which most people associate with Washington, D.C., actually has the National Museum of the American Indian in Lower Manhattan, as well at the end of Broadway. If you do come to the museum, I would suggest that you buy tickets online ahead of time. The reason for this is we are limited as to the capacity of the number of people that we can accommodate at any one time. So in order to make good use of your time when you come to visit, if you buy a ticket ahead of time, you can get a day and a time for the ticket so that you can get immediate entry into the museum. So this is the website. This will also link you to the apps, which I'll talk about in a moment. If you only have time to come to the memorial, which are the fountains up at street level that I'm sure you've seen pictures of and seen in various videos, those do not require a ticket. They're open to the public and they are available 24 hours a day. The museum opened in May of 2014. In its first year, we had 2.7 million visitors. We will probably break 3 million in our second year, but the first year was 2.7. The museum is completely underground, so you will enter at the fountains through a pavilion that was designed by the architectural team of Snohetta, and you will enter through that pavilion, and then you will go down into the exhibition. The exhibition is 100,000 square feet, and I'll explain that in meters in a moment, but it's very, very large, and it takes a lot of time to cover and to see all the programs. So I would allow 2 to 3 hours of your time. You enter through the pavilion, the Snohetta structure. You'll go through ticketing and security. There is an auditorium there, and there are a number of videos and film programs that are available in the auditorium. There is also what's called a family room, which is available only to the families of the victims, and it's a place where they can rest and gather their thoughts, and there is an interactive table there, which is a duplicate of the one in the exhibition, and it allows them to see the database of the victims of what happened. So I'll show you a picture of the table in a moment. And then you take the escalator down to the exhibition. The exhibition is just slightly over 10,000 square meters, And the reason that's important is the exhibition, the two galleries, are the footprints of where the building stood. So each of the footprints of the two towers was 50,000 square feet, and then there is a connecting space between the two, and that's what we call the interstitial space, and that's about 10,000 square feet. So the 110,000 square feet, or you can see the conversion into meters, that's what represents the footprint of the two buildings. The two designers, again, because the project was so large, the two exhibition designers, the primary designer was Tom Hennis of Think Design in New York and David Lehman of David Lehman Design in Chicago. The museum components are, there are four listed. The memorial exhibition is one of the two footprints of the two towers. The historical exhibition is the other tower. Project Rebirth is an immersion theater, six-screen multi-image theater that is about what has happened in New York City since this tragedy and how it has rebuilt itself in Lower Manhattan. And then there are four classrooms that are equipped for distance learning, and they are a point of origin for a great many programs beamed all over the United States and all over the world discussing September 11th. And I think what is unique to the museum, again, is this entire concept that you are standing where the buildings were. And it gives you a much different feeling than if you were to go to any other museum and see an exhibit about September 11th. And we make it a point of that, and you'll see that in the photographs. The footings of the building are clearly visible, and it's a focal point of the exhibition. The memorial exhibition, which is one of the pods, or one of the footings, tells the story of those that perished. So there are photographs and video programs, there are voices of the families, and there is an interactive database, which is the touch table. So the memorial exhibition, that segment of the gallery is entirely the stories of those that perished. There is limited interactivity other than the touch tables because of what we call a throughput challenge. And the throughput challenge is when we look at interactives, computer interactives, kiosks, whatever, we have to be concerned with something called dwell time. And the dwell time is the amount of time a visitor spends at that kiosk. And when you're talking about moving 30,000 people a day through the exhibition, you have to limit the dwell time. So what we've done is, besides the touch tables that talk about those that perished, a lot of the interactivity has either been moved to our website or they are done as apps. As a matter of fact, the entire audio tour, as well as other apps, are available on the Apple iTunes store, and they're all free. So it's easy to download, and a lot of the in-depth information is available through apps. We elected to do it that way because otherwise we would just have a congestion in the exhibition area, and we wanted to avoid that. And the audio tour, even if you don't come to the museum, the audio tour is worth downloading and listening to. It's very, very interesting. The historical exhibition is much more of a traditional museum exhibit. It is telling the timeline of the towers from the original construction up to the present day. It also includes the explosion that happened in 1993 when the towers were first attacked. And it talks about the exhibition or the situation up until the present day. Again, it's much more of a traditional exhibit with artifacts and other elements. There are two paths. The fast track allows you to go through the exhibition as quickly as possible for those people who have limited time. And there are also the alcoves, and these just deserve 1 minute of explanation. The alcoves are mini theaters off to the side of the fast track so that you can go in or not go in. And each alcove mini theater is identified with a graphic that tells you what you are about to see or hear so that you can decide if you want to go in or not. And particularly if you have children or other people that you may want to not take them into a particular area. By far, the most difficult program to watch is the people that jumped, that knew what was going to happen, and they jumped to kill themselves. And that's a very, very difficult program to watch. The other one that is an audio theater, many of the families donated the voicemail messages that people left, either from the towers or from the airplanes, when they realized what was about to happen, and the families were kind enough to donate the messages, and you can hear, I love you, goodbye. You know, it's very, very difficult. So anyway, those are in the alcoves. So you can either choose to see those or take your family in there or not. This is the point about it being the most covered media event. We have 140 programs running, and our goal was to be sure that they run 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, reliably. So that was our task. How it works, the technical design, there was a point raised yesterday in one of the presentations about keeping a lot of the components, the audiovisual components, out of the exhibits so that the exhibit designers didn't have to worry about ventilation or maintenance or accessibility or service or whatever. So that's what we did. We have three control rooms. They are climate controlled, dust free. All of the equipment resides in those rooms. So all of the program sources, the audio and video processing, the amplifiers, the program monitoring, the show control, everything exists in those rooms out of the exhibits. So they are all monitored and controlled that way. And our design objectives were simply to make everything safe, everything reliable, because people are expecting everything to work nowadays, and it was the best value to the client and the project. So our equipment strategies were everything had to be reliable. So everything, all the video program sources, everything here uses solid state drives. There are no mechanical hard drives. There are no DVD players. There is nothing mechanical anywhere in the system except for the cooling fans in the racks. But everything else is completely solid state and completely automated. All of the PCs are loaded with all 140 programs, so that if a PC crashes during the day, you put in a spare and it immediately seeks the right program and plays it. So all of the programs are loaded in every PC. And we have redundant power supplies on everything. 99% of the time, the component that fails is the power supply. So we have redundant power supplies on everything. And all of the signal distribution, and you'll see pictures in a moment about the control room and how this is wired, but everything is over fiber optic. There is no copper cabling in the transmission facility. And the reason we did that was that over time, they're going to want to change things and they're going to want to upgrade to 4K, to 8K, to new resolutions, new technology. So in order to allow them to continue to upgrade, everything is fiber optic throughout the distribution system. And going back to the control room, only the video displays, projectors, speakers, push buttons are in the exhibits. This is one of the control rooms under construction, but you can see all the computers, all the video processing, everything is in these racks in a climate-controlled, dust-free environment. Doesn't look dust-free now, but it was under construction. I don't expect you to read this. This is the typical video display. This is a typical interactive display. But these show the components, but there's one thing that's sort of important. This line here, this dotted line, Everything to the right is what's in the exhibits. Everything to the left is what's in the control room. So we were able to take all that equipment, put it in the control room where it would be safe, and the exhibit designers didn't have to worry about it. So that was the whole point to our design. The system show control, there is a show control system that manages everything. It does the automatic startup and shutdown every morning and every evening. It continuously monitors all of the audiovisual systems. If something goes wrong, there is an automated alert system to let a technical person know. And then there is a manual override for special events in the evening or special programs for classes. Results to date, 99% uptime, very minimal equipment failure, and managed scheduled service. So all of our design objectives have been met as far as how the system operates and sense of reliability. We also, as you know, in the US, we are very careful about accommodating the disabled. So for the deaf, we have open captioning for all video programs. For those people that come in with hearing aids, we have induction loops at every audio program for clarity, and we have volume controls for all the audio headsets, so when you listen to the voicemail messages or whatever, when you pick up a headset, they all have volume controls. Moving forward, what we've tried to do is create an infrastructure that would allow for new technologies, 4K, 8K, whatever is coming down the next big technology. And we've also allowed for flexibility in the control room design to host new technologies as they become available. The exhibit's going to be there for a very, very long time, and we try to design in as much flexibility as possible. Okay, now the pictures. This is the entrance to the exhibition. This is leaving the pavilion, which is the street level entry point. And you're going to go down a ramp with a number of these video presentations, which were snippets of audio conversations and people's reaction when it started to happen. So these are a number of video projections as you're going down the ramp. And we'll come back to this in a moment. There are a couple of elements here. On the left is the slurry wall. For those of you who have heard about this, and I don't know how many of you have seen pictures of it, this is the slurry wall that was able to stay intact. On the other side of that wall is the Hudson River. If in fact that wall had given way, this whole thing would have been flooded and it would have had a completely different outcome. So the slurry wall is what's holding back the Hudson River. And the column that you see on the right is the last column standing. That was the last column. And all the colored items on that are people that have signed it over time. So this is the slurry wall. This is some of the steel. To the right, you'll see the touchscreen interactive station. What these do is the interstitial space is a resting point between the two exhibitions, and this is access to the website and access to other information databases. These are benches where people can sit when they're resting between the two exhibition points. This is some of the steel, and these are more of the interactive stations. Again, this is the central area that's sort of the resting point. This is the memorial exhibition, and this is much more of a typical traditional museum exhibit. This is where the large artifacts were. This was, you've probably seen the iconic photographs of Ladder 3. This was the first fire truck that arrived on the scene. And over on the left is the one surviving, or not surviving, but an elevator motor that actually turned up on the site. There's the elevator motor. But again, the exhibition, this particular historical exhibition, is much more of a traditional museum exhibition. This is the interstitial space, and to the left is what was called the survivor's staircase. It was moved here, and this was the last intact staircase. Vesey, if you're familiar with that area of Lower Manhattan, at Vesey Street Station, and this was the survivor's staircase that was the last escape route. This is the memorial exhibition. So it is a mixture of still photographs that you can see on the left, and you can see projection on the right wall. The projection are the names of those that perished. This is the inside of the memorial, one of the galleries in the memorial exhibition, and you can see the projection on both walls, and this goes through their name, their photograph, when they were born. And it also are the voices of the families talking about their family members. And if you notice at the bottom, you'll see the glass floor, and you can, so what you're looking at are the footings of the building. So again, you're on the site of where the buildings were. These are the interactive touch tables. These are where the families can see it privately in the family room, but this is available to the public. So this is a database of all 3,000 people that perished. Another shot of the memorial exhibition. And these are the footings. This is around the perimeter of the exhibition space, and these are the actual footings of where the buildings were. So it's important to us to keep emphasizing that link, because it, amazingly enough, a lot of people don't realize the fact that they are standing where the buildings were. And this is another picture of the Vesey Street. This is the survivor stairs. So you can't actually walk the stairs. You're walking parallel to them on another staircase, but they're there available. And this I wanted to show you because it gives you an idea of the volume of the space and why we had to use fiber optic cabling for everything. The space is huge. Not only is it 110,000 square feet or over 10,000 square meters, but it's enormous in its height. So to wire all of this would have been impossible with standard or traditional cabling. You can also see in the back there some projection on the walls. There are a number of projections on the concrete walls. And this is another picture of the slurry wall. And there you can see the last column a little better from where people have signed it there on the left. And I think we'll do questions, I guess, at the end of the session.
Yes.
Thank you.